I want you to imagine a scene. In our imagination, we're going back nearly 3,000 years. And we're standing outside the great gateway of Jerusalem. The gates are closed. There's a huge crowd gathered where you're standing outside the gates. And you recognize in the crowd people you know from towns all over the land of Judah. People have gathered in their thousands from all across the country. And they're all standing in silence. They're just waiting for something to happen. You know that something tremendously important is about to happen. You look up to the wall of the city above you, and all along the wall you can see thousands more people. It looks as if all the population of Jerusalem has crowded up there onto the wall, and the people there are waiting in silence too. And then you sense a ripple of excitement going through the crowd. People on the wall are pointing. They're pointing down the road that winds its way up to the city gates. And you look to see what it is they're pointing to, and you can see a little cloud of dust on the road, a mile or so away. And other people are looking now too. And the elderly folk in the crowd who have been sitting on the ground, they get to their feet. And the children who are playing in the dust, they all stand to attention. The whole crowd is watching. You watch as the cloud of dust gets closer. And as it gets closer, you can see more clearly now. It's a group of men. And as they come closer again, you can pick out the figures. There's a man at the front, a little way ahead of all the others. And he's riding. He's riding on a donkey. And behind him, there's marching a little band of men. And as they get closer, they look like tough characters. You'd think they were grizzled old soldiers. But they're not in armor now. They're not carrying weapons. They're in bright, festive robes. And now this group is just 100 yards away. 50 yards, 20 yards, 10 yards away. And still the crowd is silent. And now the man at the front of that little group halts, and he gets down from his donkey, and he stands, and he looks up at the great gateway, and he looks at the locked gates, and he stands and waits. And suddenly one of the figures on the wall steps forward where everybody can see him. And you know who it is. He's the gatekeeper. He's the man who has the responsibility to guard the gates of the city. And he holds up his hands for silence. He doesn't really need to, because everyone is already silent. And then he speaks. Before all the thousands of waiting people, he calls out a question. But he's not putting the question to the people. He's looking up to heaven. He's calling out to God. And this is the question that he shouts to the heavens. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? And then another figure steps forward. And you recognize him too. He's the high priest. He's the man who's the spokesman of God to Israel. And he begins to chant the answer to the question. He whose walk is blameless, and who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from his heart. And as he chants those words, the crowd begins to chant with him, because they all know these words. The man who speaks the truth from his heart, and has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbor no wrong, and casts no slur on his fellow man, who despises a vile man, but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps his oath even when it hurts, who lends his money without usury, who does not accept a bribe against the innocent, he who does these things will never be shaken. And then suddenly, as the chant comes to an end, the gates swing open. And the man who's waiting there steps through the gates. And the crowds explode into cheering and clapping and singing. This man strides forward with his little band of followers behind him. And he walks through the streets of Jerusalem. And the crowds fall in behind them, shouting and cheering. And on he strides to the foot of Mount Zion, the hill on which the temple is built, and beside the temple, the royal palace. And on he climbs up to the temple. He's come there to be crowned. This is his coronation day. That's why he's come to Jerusalem. He's come to be crowned. There in the temple, he's going to spend the coming hours dedicating himself to the service of the Lord. And then in the sight of all the people, he's going to be anointed and crowned. And then when his time in the temple is done, then he'll move on to the palace. And there he'll take his seat on his throne. He's going to reign as king over God's people. And that's where he'll spend the rest of his life, in the temple and in the palace. He's got the right to go into the temple at any time, to meet with God, to have fellowship with God, to seek God's blessing on himself and on his people, to look to God for guidance and for help. He's a welcome guest in God's palace, in God's home. He's got the right to live on God's holy hill. He's the king. Well, I said I wanted you to use your imagination. And I've had to do that too. Because we don't know exactly what the ceremony was that was followed on a coronation day in Judah. And many of the details in my picture are imaginary. But the way that this psalm, the psalm we've read, the psalm we've sung, was used in Old Testament times was something like that. It was a psalm written for a coronation or a royal procession. And the question the psalm asks is this: who is worthy to be king over God's people? That's the question that's being asked in the first verse of the psalm. The question falls into two halves, and when you look at it, the first half asks, Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? And the word dwell there means, who can stay as a guest in your sanctuary? And that was the special privilege of the king. And the king of Judah, the king descended from David's line, he had the right to stay as a guest in God's holy temple. He had the right to go in and out and to meet with God there. And the second half of the question asks, and who may live on your holy hill? And the word live means live permanently, make his residence there. The king's palace, and we've just said, stood alongside the temple on God's holy hill, on Mount Zion. There was only one man who had the right to live on the holy hill of Zion, and that was the king. So the psalm is asking, who is worthy to be the king? Who is worthy to live there on God's holy hill? Who is worthy to have his palace alongside God's palace? That's the question that's being asked in this psalm. Who is worthy to be enthroned as king? Who has the right to go in and have fellowship with God as God's friend in God's house? And who has the right to have his throne alongside God's throne? You see, that was the role that the king played in ancient Judah. Everyone knew that God was the supreme king, the king, the great king, the ultimate king. And the Lord Yahweh, the great king, ruled from his temple on Mount Zion. That was the centre of his kingdom. Some of you know, right in the innermost room of the temple, there was the mysterious Ark of the Covenant. And above it was a slab of pure gold. In the Authorised Version, it's called the Mercy Seat. In some modern translations, the Atonement Cover. And extending upwards from the Mercy Seat, looking down were the carved forms of golden cherubim. And the Mercy Seat was the place where God made his presence known. It was the focal point of God's dwelling on earth. It was his throne. That's the way it's described in the Old Testament. So there at the heart of the temple was the throne room of God. But right alongside the temple was the palace of the king. So the throne of the earthly king was right there alongside the throne of the ultimate king. So when a king from David's line, when a worthy king took his place on the throne in his palace, you could almost say that he was being allowed to share the throne of God. He was being crowned alongside God. He was being allowed to sit on the same holy mountain where God sat. God, the great king, would exercise his kingship through the earthly king. God, the ultimate king, would exercise his power, his authority, through this man who sat alongside him. Now, what man is worthy of that? That's the question the psalmist is asking. Lord, who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? What man is worthy to sit on that throne and to rule as your representative over your people? It was such a vital question. The people of Judah knew that everything depended on them having a king who was worthy to sit on that throne. If you had a worthy king, if you had a king who truly represented God's character, then through that king, God's blessing, God's peace, God's power could flow to the whole people. This is how David put it in 2 Samuel chapter 23. He's telling us why it's so vital to have a worthy king. The God of Israel spoke, the Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over men in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he's like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness after rain that brings the grass from the earth. What a picture of what the king was supposed to be to his people. A king who rules in righteousness, a king who rules in the fear of God. He's like the light of morning at sunrise. Imagine a darkened world, and then the sun begins to rise on the horizon, and light begins to flood over the whole scene. It's a cloudless morning, and very soon this brightness is shining over everything. That's what the king is to be to God's people. That as he rules there in righteousness, in holiness, in the fear of the Lord, light begins to flood across all of God's people. The light of life, the light of hope, the light of peace, it's there, breaking through the darkness. But it's all because the right king is there, because a worthy king is sitting on the throne. He's like the brightness after rain that brings the grass from the earth. What produces freshness? What produces life? What is it that brings a renewed life to a barren garden? Well, first the rain and then the sun. And that's what the king is to be to his people. God's people in Old Testament times knew that they could only be a people filled with freshness and life if the king was sitting there on his throne, ruling in the fear of God. Or again, this is how King Solomon is pictured. This is in Psalm 72. The picture is very similar. He'll be like rain falling on a mown field. He'll be like showers watering the earth. In his days the righteous will flourish, and prosperity will abound till the moon is no more. What a picture of a king. He's like rain, but in a land where the sun beats down mercilessly, there's nothing more wonderful than rain. When rain begins to fall, then there's life, there's hope, there's prosperity. Without the rain, there can only be barrenness. Well, the king sitting on his throne, a worthy king, will be like rain falling on a mown field. But the opposite is true as well. What if you have an unworthy king? What if you have a sinful king? What if you have a greedy or a dishonest king? What will be the consequences of that? Well, he'll bring shame and he'll bring judgment on himself. But not just that. He'll bring guilt on the whole nation. You see this very clearly in the life of David. There was an occasion when David's general, Joab, murdered an innocent man called Abner. And David knew nothing about it till it was over. He never gave his consent to that. And this is what he says. When David heard about it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, son of Ner. May his blood fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house." David is saying, if I had ordered that murder, if I had been guilty of the blood of Abner, it would not just have been me that was guilty. The whole kingdom would have become guilty. But I and my kingdom are forever innocent in this matter. It's only Joab and his own family who will suffer for this, because it's Joab's sin. But if it had been my sin, says David, I know what that would have meant for the nation. I know that the whole nation would have come under a curse. The whole nation would have needed to be punished by God. A guilty king brings guilt on the whole nation. And you see that happening, don't you, at other points in David's life. this tragic episode. Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. It was something that was against God's will and God's command. So David said to Joab and the commanders of the troops, "Go and count the Israelites from Beersheba to Dan, then report back to me so that I may know how many there are." It was an act of disobedience and rebellion and pride on David's part. But Joab replied, "May the Lord multiply his troops 100 times over. My lord the king, are they not all my lord's subjects? Why does my lord want to do this? Why should he bring guilt on Israel?" Joab knows that if David does this, it won't just be David who'll be held guilty. David is the king. David is one with the whole people. He's the representative of the whole nation. If he sins, it'll bring guilt on the whole nation. But David goes ahead and does it. And God judges David. But he doesn't just judge David. A prophet is sent to David, and this is what the prophet had to say to David. "Take your choice. 3 years of famine. 3 years of being swept away before your enemies with their swords overtaking you. Or 3 days of the sword of the Lord. Days of plague in the land with the angel of the Lord ravaging every part of Israel." David has sinned. But it's not only David who'll be held guilty. It's not only David who'll be judged. It's not only David who'll know the appalling suffering that's coming one way or another, whether it's through famine or whether it's through enemy occupation or whether it's through plague. It's the whole of Israel, the whole of God's people who are going to suffer now because the king has sinned, because the king has rebelled against God. You see, what underlies all these passages is this, that the king and his people really are one. That they're joined, that they're united. So if the king is obedient to God, if the king is righteous, then God will count the whole nation, the whole people as righteous, for the king's sake. But if the king is wicked, if the king sins against God, then God will treat the whole nation as guilty. The people of Judah, the people of Israel, they understood that their life and the life of the king were locked together. They realized that they could only stand if he stood, that if he fell, they would fall with him. This is the way that the writer of Lamentations describes the king, the Lord's anointed, our very life breath. That's what the king was to God's people in Old Testament times. He was their very life breath. Their whole existence depended on him. Because it was through the king that God would rule over his people. It was through the king that he would bring his blessing upon them. It was through the king that they would be counted as righteous or guilty. He's our very lifeblood, says the writer of Lamentations, our very life's breath. We thought that under his shadow we would live among the nations. How can we live? That was their question. We can only live if we live under the shadow of a righteous king. Only if he's protecting us. Only if he is guarding us by his righteousness can we be alive before God. Now, do you see what lies behind the question of Psalm 15? Do you see why it was such a vital question for every member of God's nation? What sort of king do we need? What must he be like in order to take that place alongside God, to be God's representative reigning on the holy hill? What does it take to be a truly worthy king? And that's the question that's answered in the remainder of the psalm. To be a truly worthy king, his walk must be blameless. He must do what is righteous. He must have integrity. What does it mean when it says that he must be blameless, that he must do what is righteous? Well, it simply means that at every point he must forget about himself, about his own wishes, his own interests, his own concerns, and he must do exactly what is right, what is God-pleasing, what is according to God's law at every point. It's the broadest of words. He must be blameless. He must be righteous. It's saying that in every area of this man's character, in every area of his conduct, you must be able to say, yes, this man is walking in a way that matches God's own character. God is the righteous one. God is the one who is perfect and spotless in all his ways. Well then, to be a worthy king, a man must reflect the character of God perfectly, and he must walk in a way that reveals that character. He must speak the truth from his heart. Not only his actions, his walk must be blameless, but he must be utterly truthful. How can you trust a king if he's going to deceive, if he's going to lie to his people, if he's going to twist the truth? To be a righteous king, he has to be somebody who can be depended upon to speak from the heart, so that you know that what he says is what he means, and what he means is what he says, and there's no dissimulation and there's no going back on his word. He speaks the truth. And he has no slander on his tongue. He has no malice towards people. A man who slanders his neighbour does so because he's got some hatred, some personal malice against his neighbour. He wants to destroy his neighbour's reputation. He wants to undermine his neighbour's standing. But a king has got to be utterly impartial. He's got to forget about personal feelings towards individuals, and he's got to deal with every person in justice. There's no room for a king who lies. Do you remember Ahab in the Old Testament? And how he sets his heart on Naboth's vineyard, and how he rages against Naboth because Naboth won't sell his family inheritance. And then the lies that Ahab and Jezebel concoct against Naboth in order to destroy him. Who could worship a king like that? Who could give honour to a king like that? Who could trust a king like that? A man who'll stab his own subjects in the back and lie about them. If this is to be a worthy king, he must be truthful as God is truthful. He does his neighbour no wrong. As so often, the NIV has smoothed out the force of the line. What it's saying is that a person who has been his friend, he won't suddenly turn round and treat him as an enemy. He'll be loyal. We need that, don't we? We need a king who shares God's quality of loyalty. The very name of God, the Lord, Yahweh, the faithful one, the loyal one, the one who can say about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, even centuries after they're in the grave, I'm still their God. The God who makes friendships and never breaks them. The God who can be trusted never to turn round and break his promises. He does his neighbour no wrong.
Well, it's a very weak way of putting it, but you can see what the psalmist is saying about the king, that he must match God in God's loyalty, that he's not going to stab his friend in the back. And he casts no slur on his fellow man. And what sort of king is it who loses his temper and just starts pouring out abuse and angry words against people? We need a king who's calm, a king who's measured, a king who doesn't let his feelings swamp his judgment. We need a king who can be trusted to speak words of wisdom in every situation, not pouring out abuse when his emotions are stirred. We need a king who's perfectly just, who knows who should be honoured and who must not be honoured. This king despises a vile man, but honours those who fear the Lord. He knows how to weigh people up. He knows what's really important. He knows what the values are that really matters. And as he looks at his subjects, what he's looking for more than anything is for people who fear the Lord. And those are the people whom he treasures. Those are the people whom he lifts up. Those are the people to whom he gives honour. But equally, he despises the vile. He won't put into a position of authority. He won't commend somebody whom he knows to be crooked. They may be clever. They may be gifted. They may be brilliant at spin. But this perfect king says, no, I'm having no vile man and promoted in my kingdom. This king keeps his oath even when it hurts. He makes promises. And having made a promise, you know that that promise stands. You know that if it costs him half his kingdom, this king will keep his promises. You know that if it costs him his whole kingdom, this king will keep his promises. You know that if it costs the king his life, if it costs him his lifeblood, he will keep his promises. Oh, to have a king like that in this corrupt world, in this world where we all assume that politicians are going to lie to us and break their promises. To have a king who, once he's made a promise, it's rock solid. You can go to him and claim that promise at any time and know that he will not go back on his word. A king who lends his money without usury. In other words, who says, whatever I own is there for the sake of my people. If they need it, it's for them. I don't look to get a profit back. I simply am willing to give. I'm willing to make everything I have available to my people. A king who doesn't accept a bribe against the innocent. An incorruptible king. A king who is going to protect the innocent. Who, if there are others conspiring against them, who want to have the king on their side, will defend the innocent rather than joining in the conspiracy. That's the sort of king that God's people need. A king who's blameless in action and in word. A king who's kind and who's loyal and who's measured and wise. A king who is true to his word always. A king who is utterly generous and gives and gives and gives. A king who's incorruptible. A king who is like that. He who does these things will never be shaken. He's rock solid. And that means his kingdom is rock solid. And that means his people are safe under his kingship. King like other kings will be swept from their throne. Other kings will fall. But a king who's like that, a king who is really worthy to reign, a king who reflects God's own character perfectly, will reign eternally. and his people will live under his shadow forever. And where are God's people going to find such a king? All through Old Testament times, people were singing this psalm, saying that's what it means to be a worthy king. And all the time they were waiting. And they had some relatively good kings, and they had some relatively awful kings. Some kings who ruled with a measure of wisdom, and some kings who ruled in the most abominably foolish ways. But even the best of their kings fell 1,000 miles short of this. Where are you going to find a king whose walk is blameless? Where are you going to find a king who does what is righteous perfectly, who really does match God's character? If he's going to share God's throne, if he's going to sit alongside the living God, then he's going to need to have the character of God. He's going to need to be holy as God is holy. Who else could be trusted to reign over God's people and to reign over God's world except a king who matches God's own character perfectly? We read about that king earlier from Revelation chapter 5. Who is worthy? Who is worthy to take the scroll from the hand of the Father? Who's worthy to rule the world and to unfold its history? Who is worthy to reign from the throne of God, to share that throne? Who's worthy? And no one was found. And John wept because no one was found. In all the universe they searched. The angels searched through the earth, searched through the heavens. And where can you find a man who's worthy to rule over God's people, to rule over God's world? John wept because none... And then the cry goes up. A worthy king has been found. And the Lamb steps forward. The Lamb, carrying still the marks of the bloody death by which he was slain. The Lamb who has been obedient to death, even the death of the cross. The Lord Jesus steps into the picture. And the cry goes up, "You are worthy." He takes the scroll from the hand of the Father. From now on, he is going to rule the universe. He is going to make all things work together for good. He is the one who's going to direct the events of history, and who is then going to rule over God's people in his Father's name for all eternity. Jesus, the only worthy king. When you read this psalm, you're reading a description of Jesus. Reading a description of the only king whom you can trust. The only king who is worthy to be trusted. The only king whom the Father trusts enough to put him on the throne. In the end, it's not our verdict on Jesus that matters. Yes, we cry, "Thou art worthy." But the more important thing is that the Father has said that he's worthy. The Father has watched his Son give perfect obedience. Even hanging on a cross, he's heard his Son praying for his enemies, "Father, forgive them." He's watched his Son die in perfect obedience. Still loving, still trusting, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. The Father has watched his Son living a life of perfect obedience and culminating that life in a death of perfect grace. And the Father has said to Jesus, you're worthy. You're worthy. And the Father has lifted him up to the throne. And the Father has appointed him king over his people forever. When we shout to the Lord Jesus, you are worthy, we're only echoing the Father's cry of delight. The Lord Jesus, in his extraordinary, unique kingship, has promised to share the kingdom with his people. There in those verses in Revelation 5, the worshippers round the throne, bless God, bless the Lamb, because the Lamb has redeemed men for God and has appointed them to be a kingdom. The Father, the Lord Jesus, not only shares his righteousness with us, not only are we counted as righteous for his sake, the Lord Jesus imparts his righteousness to us. One day the words of Psalm 15 aren't only going to apply to the Lord Jesus, they're going to apply to all who are joined to Jesus, to all who are in him. We're going to sit on the throne with the Lord Jesus. We shall be seated with him forever, sharing his joys, sharing his triumphs, sharing his reign, because he's remade us by his grace.